You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of us are looking for ways to make exercise more fun and to feel more motivated. Turns out music might be able to help us with that. We'll hear more from a Wisconsin researcher on music and exercise. Right now, we check in with reporters from around the state for our Wisconsin News Roundup. First, Milwaukee is planning a cleanup of its estuary, one of the most polluted spots on the Great Lakes. Corinne Hess is a WPR News reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you describe the estuary and the pollution concerns there, Corey?
Yes, so this area has been polluted for more than 30 years. It's a result of Milwaukee's long manufacturing heritage. And just years ago, there weren't the safety measures in place, the pollution measures in place that we have now. So what has happened is the rivers, the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick rivers and some local creeks and the lakeshore of Lake Michigan just has a lot of pollution and heavy metals, chemicals from burned oil and gas and coal and garbage from over the years that needs to be cleaned up.
And that takes us to this 8-year plan. What goes into it?
Well, yeah, over the next 8 years, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and our local DNR and local agencies will be spending a little over $29 million to begin the process of this. And they're confident that they can get it cleaned up in 8 years.
And who's picking up the price tag for that $29 million?
Right. So the EPA is going to be paying for about 65%, and then the local governments will be paying for the rest. They're also hoping that some nonprofit organizations will step up and do some of the work. And what the work entails is, you know, feasibility studies, soil testing, and then the sediment cleanup and the ultimate removal of some of this.
And the goal here is to make this, right now it's regarded as one of the most polluted sites in the Great Lakes. Is the goal to kind of turn that status around?
Yeah, so this estuary is one of five sites in Wisconsin that is listed on an area of concern list, which is considered one of the most contaminated sites on the Great Lakes. And the goal is to remove it from that list. And so that happens once the toxic sediment is removed and that this area is restored so the water is considered safe for people to use for fishing and recreation.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Corinne Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She talked with us about an 8-year plan to clean up the Milwaukee estuary, as we just heard, one of the most polluted spots right now in the Great Lakes. Now, the chancellor at UW-Whitewater said in a campus-wide letter that in order to address a drop in revenue, the school is considering cuts to faculty and staff. Davey Shastri is the education reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Davey, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
What have we seen in terms of enrollment at UW-Whitewater, and what has that meant for the revenue there?
Yeah, so the chancellor's letter from late last week said that enrollment has been declining at UW-Whitewater on the main campus since 2016. That year it topped out at a little over 12,600 students. And since then, they've seen a little over an 8% drop. So that translates to $11 million less in tuition revenue for the university based off of the university's numbers.
What kind of cuts, then, is the administration at UW-Whitewater talking about?
So in his letter to the campus earlier, in the days past, he said that there would be some combination of contract non-renewals, reduction in appointment times, and then layoffs. And layoffs was obviously the big word that, raised concerns on campus. There's nothing clear on how many. And it's also in recent days, as this conversation has progressed, the administration has kind of changed their pitch a little bit, saying that that was meant to start a conversation and that nothing is set in stone.
Right. This sounds like a beginning of a process to decide what the cuts will be. Does that sound about right?
It seems like it, but if you talk to faculty, they'd also tell you, in a lot of faculty in leadership positions, that like these conversations have been going on for the past couple weeks. So it's moving very quickly, and then it got to the point of issuing this letter to the university, and it's moving forward from there. So yeah, it is a very fresh conversation, but it also sounds like decisions are moving quickly.
You write in your piece that UW-Whitewater is not the only college in the state that's dealing with this issue, revenue loss because of declining enrollment and potential cuts. Where else are we seeing this in the state?
Yeah, a lot of universities are starting to struggle with this. And if they're not seeing current deficits or losses in revenue, they're trying to be proactive about like anticipated losses. UW Oshkosh a couple of years ago said that they had a $9.5 million budget gap. And then they have been trying to deal with that through some early retirement offers most recently. They also were looking at not reappointing some people on short-term contracts. Then UW Stevens Point made a lot of headlines when they said, you know, they weren't able to keep the university as large as it is because of an enrollment. And they tried to cut a bunch of majors, including history, and they ended up backing away from that because they shrunk by 130 faculty and staff positions over like 6 years. And even on the private side, universities are starting to get nervous about this. And Marquette University here in Milwaukee, which is, you know, the largest private university in the state, they had layoffs and shrunk by 2.5% of their faculty and staff size. And their president has been talking a lot about getting prepared for these declines in enrollment that are projected over the next 5 to 10 years.
Davey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Davey Shastri covers education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked with us about staffing cuts being considered at UW-Whitewater, and she wraps up our weekly roundup of news from around Wisconsin. Now we head to Wood County in central Wisconsin, where the owner of a cheese factory is being charged with defrauding dozens of farmers out of their milk payments. Nathaniel Shuda is an editor at the Oshkosh Northwestern and a breaking news reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Nathaniel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
It was announced yesterday that the owner of Dairy State Cheese in Rudolph has been charged with apparently stealing from dairy farmers in the area. Can you talk about what happened here?
Sure. So what the DOJ is saying is that the owner, Michael Moran, tried to skim money from dairy farmers. So what would happen is that the USDA sets the price of milk, and if the cheesemaker then goes and gives them less than that amount, they're charged with or they're supposed to then turn around and cut a check for the difference. And what the DOJ is alleging is that Mr. Moran then turned around and pocketed those checks and kept the money for himself.
Right. So they actually, they're fraudulently signing these checks. Can you talk about the mechanics of this, I guess, alleged scam?
Sure. So he would write out checks to the dairy farmers for the amount that was owed as directed by a USDA auditor. And then when the auditor left, what the DOJ says is that that he then turned around and signed those checks, put them into his cash register, and then at the end of the week deposited them into his bank account.
And how did this come to light?
So the USDA, which oversees this process, got a complaint in February of 2017. So at that point, the USDA started investigating, and it took several months for them to gather enough evidence. And then they turned that evidence over to the Wisconsin Department of Justice, which then did its own investigation leading up to the charges that were filed this week.
And as we wrap up, is there a timeline on the trial and what this could mean for the farmers?
There is an initial court appearance scheduled for February that is coming up. And I was told by an attorney for the company that they anticipate all of the farmers will get back the money that they were owed.
Nathaniel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sounds good. Thank you.
That's Nathaniel Sciutto with the Oshkosh Northwestern and USA Today Network Wisconsin, bringing us up to date on a story of alleged fraud at a state cheese manufacturing place. Maybe you've had a moment where you wanted to quit or just weren't feeling your workout, your exercise plan, until that perfect song came on. Well, what does the research say about music and exercise? Can it make us work harder and longer? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a person who generally reaches for your headphones before your exercise? And what is your go-to song to get you pumped up and keep you going? Call 800-642-1234 or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carl Foster is an exercise physiologist with interests ranging from clinical exercise physiology to elite sport physiology. He's director of the Human Performance Lab and director of research in the Clinical Exercise Physiology graduate program at UW-La Crosse. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob.
What led you to study the role of music in our exercise?
Well, we have graduate students who have to do thesis projects, so you're all the time doing stuff. And about 20 years ago, a student of mine named Mark Schwartzmiller, who had been a musician when he was an undergraduate and was searching around for a subject, came in and said, could we do something on music? And everybody knows that, you know, the music comes on and you tap your toes or bounce up and down. And so we read in the literature a little bit and we realized that there were some gaps. And so we wound up just doing a thesis project where we wanted to see if we sped the music up or slowed it down, if the pace of exercise would follow that. And indeed it did. And that was, you know, again, one of these serendipitous things where you do something sort of by accident. And it turned out it had a little bit of legs. And now we've done about a dozen studies over the last 20 years or so.
Now, is it different the way music affects us if we're sort of a novice exercise person like me versus an elite athlete?
Probably not. It probably affects everybody to some degree. There's some evidence that people who are more extroverted will seek out more sort of driving, fast tempo, loud music than people who are a little more introverted. But I suspect, and I think our data supports it, that almost everybody responds at one level or the other to music. It's, although you have to find your own taste and the kind of music that you enjoy.
Let's get to one that you mentioned as an inspirational song to us, Queen. Who doesn't like to listen to some Queen? Here's a listen, and we'll talk about the tempo here.
Okay.
Okay, now I think of, you know, people wanted exercise to fast music. I think I checked this out at like 90 beats per minute or something, a little slower than I would think. So how does that fit into our workout, our exercise routine?
Well, 90 is actually at the slow end of music that's used, but the beat in that song is so powerful that it grabs almost everybody. For the average person, somewhere around 120 to 140 beats per minute seems to be the most useful, but I suspect it's cultural. And I'd remarked to one of your producers before the show that, I'm a fairly old guy. I'm in my 70s and I listen to country and Western music, which has a tempo of about 90. And I say to people that that's the speed of an old person's soul. You know, I move slower than my students do. And the music I like is different. And we know there's a lot of meaning and cultural attachment to music that varies person to person.
Now, people might not know off the top of their head what 140 beats per minute sounds like. You mentioned that at a higher pace. We asked around here. J. Carlisle Larson, one of our producers, has some go-to songs. Decepticon by Le Tigre, Sabotage by the Beastie Boys, and then Toxic by Britney Spears. I want to get a little taste of that. I think this one clocks at 145. All right, Carl, if we're, say, running and we hear music at that pace or doing whatever exercise, do we adjust ourselves to try to go along with that pace?
Yeah, we do, but the problem with running and walking is you're mechanically constrained by having to move your legs. It's a lot different than pedaling a bicycle in a gym where you can take tension off or add tension. So running, you probably increase your stride length as much as you increase your tempo. And in fact, the very, very first study we ever did was one of my colleagues had a company that wanted to make a commercial claim that they had a music that could drive people to walk at certain speeds. And so we tried it out, and we did the experiment to see if their claims were valid. But the problem is with walking, you're almost always at about 90 or 100 steps per minute because mechanically you just can't walk faster than that. But if you get onto, a bicycle where you can adjust your pedaling speed a lot more freely, and then the other thing you'll find is that people will entrain at maybe a 2-to-1 rhythm. So if you had really, really fast music that, let's say, was 180 beats per minute, you might entrain at 120 or 90 or some evenly divisible ratio to the beat of the music. But almost inevitably, if you get fast-moving, strong-beat music, almost everybody will increase their effort. Now, having said that, we did a study with some high-level cyclists some years ago and wanted to see if they were riding a time trial, which means they're riding as hard as they possibly can. Do they go faster? And in fact, they didn't at all. And we were, in fact, a little worried they might go too fast, too early, and get in trouble. But it seems like that the feedback you're getting from your body when you're going really, really hard so tells you to sort of stop listening to the music and go at the pace that fits the task you're doing. But if you're in a workout mode where the level of intensity is submaximal, then the music is able to speed you up or slow you down.
Talking to Carl Foster, exercise physiologist at UW La Crosse, looking at the role of music and exercise, how music can help our workouts. We'll go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Woodruff. Mike, hello.
Hello. I was calling because I work out at about 4 o'clock every morning at home in the basement, and I listen to a kind of an eclectic variety of music that seems to get me in a good mood, that I think almost a meditative state where I can focus, and I'll listen to one or two, maybe three songs for a whole 45-minute workout, anything from Pantera to R.E.M. to the Talking Heads to Eddie Money, just kind of some classic songs that I get stuck in my head, and I'll just repeat them through the whole thing.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. That's interesting, Carl. It sounds like he gets into kind of a flow state by listening to the same songs again and again.
Yeah, that's the term that's often used in the literature. And I'll find myself doing the same thing. I have a playlist, but it's so some days I go back and repeat the same song several times because I just happen to like it that day. And the other thing that's important is music is arousing. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, most people need arousing, and so it helps you sort of wake up when your body perhaps isn't ready to wake up.
Thanks for that call. Let's bring on Dennis now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I go back to an oldie. It's from St. Elmo's Fire, the theme song Man in Motion by John Parr.
Yeah, that's a kind of an upbeat, inspiring kind of tune. And regardless of beat, Carl, is there something about the inspirational side of the music we listen to?
Yeah, there's definitely meaning to music. It's different for different people. The guy, it's worth mentioning, if the listeners are interested, the guy who's the big expert in the world is an English guy named Costas Karagiorgas. And if you just go in and Google music and exercise and science, his name will pop up. And one of the examples he uses is Vangelis, the opening for Chariots of Fire, mm-hmm. which is a fairly low tempo music, but it's so associated with that wonderful movie. The people listen to that, and you know it's a very popular song, even though its tempo is a little bit down.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dennis. I've heard people, Carl, say that listening to music can reduce pain, and that goes along with exercise. Do we have any research on whether that actually works?
Well, I'm not sure there's any data on pain per se, like you got a bad knee or a sprained ankle or something. But in people that are doing fairly heavy exercise and it just sort of wears out and you don't want to do it anymore, but very often the tendency to entrain to a beat allows you to keep going. and it also serves as a distractive tract. Now, however, we've done the experiment one time where we had people do a task that was 45 minutes long on the bike, and it was difficult, and we had a playlist that they wanted to listen to. We had Larry the Cable Guy, a comedy thing that's, if you're sitting still, is very funny, but after 40 minutes on the bike, it wasn't doing the job. And then we had some really non-rhythmic sounds like you do for yoga or meditation. And when you got tired and didn't want to keep going, if the music had a strong beat, you would entrain and could keep going. And elsewise, we had people just say, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm off the bike. And so at least in terms of the discomfort that you get from going fairly hard, the music's capable of helping you. But having said that, if you're an athlete and you're going all the way out, it probably doesn't. We've done that experiment as well.
Carl, thanks so much for sharing your research with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Good. I enjoyed talking to you.
It's Carl Foster, exercise physiologist, director of the Human Performance Laboratory at UW La Crosse. He joined us to talk about picking music to fuel your workout. You can share yours still over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Got a lot of suggestions from around here. Maybe this will help your playlist some. We got Steve Gotcher, a technical director of Beta, says Rebirth Groove by the Rebirth Brass Band helps him when he's on the bike trainer. Colleen Leahy says Luxury by Azalea Banks. Eric Talmadge from Business Sponsorship says Eminem, Lose Yourself. That's in that aspiring category. Dean Kallenbach, regional manager in Eau Claire, says the theme from Rocky, particularly the Maynard Ferguson version. Yeah, we got that. And I don't know if this is the Maynard Ferguson one, though. I think this is the original. Kathy Kappa, Membership Services, says I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor. Dean Knetter from our own Central Time, Back Where You Started by Tina Turner. The list keeps going on. Tim Peterson, I see him over there. Lenny Kravitz's version of American Woman. You had one, didn't you, Sarah? What was yours? Where is it? Oh, here it is. Grizz, Tiger Kingdom Space Camp has an awesome brass part.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So lots of great inspirational music. The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump continues today with a long-awaited debate over whether to include new witnesses. There was a question about whether former National Security Advisor John Bolton would testify about his conversations with President Trump about Ukraine. But this afternoon, Senate Republicans appear to have the votes to block new witnesses. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. She's also assistant dean for student success. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, we've been watching some Republican U.S. senators very closely today. It looks like a couple of key senators have said they're going to vote no on the idea of new witnesses. What are you looking at when you hear their arguments, their statements in favor of not taking these witnesses?
So the people you're referring to are Senators Lamar Alexander and Lisa Murkowski, I assume. And in the case of both of them, they came forward and indicated that they had seen enough in terms of what's already been presented, and they didn't see any need to see anything further in regard to witnesses. And both, I would say, went a step further, and they were also critical of the impeachment as it's gone forward, and said more than maybe I thought they were going to say about their dissatisfaction with the entire process.
Right, Senator Alexander, though, in his in a tweet thread, said he thought the House had made the case that President Trump had asked for foreign interference in the election. He thought that the quid pro quo concept had been established, but that he didn't think it rose to the heights of impeachment. Not exactly, I think, what President Trump wants to hear from Republican senators.
No, well, I guess that is true. He also did call the second article, though, frivolous.
Right.
I would say also that in addition to a tweet thread, he also issued a full statement, and I read it that way as opposed to 15 tweets. But I know Twitter is what we do now. But you're right in that sense that he did indicate that he thought that the House had shown a lot of the misconduct and the like, but that, in fact, it was not something that he thought rose to the level of meeting the bar for removing a president from office.
And we had some response today to this news. Former chief of staff to President Trump, Marine General John Kelly, said he was happy to be speaking today. He said, if I was advising the United States Senate, I would say if you don't respond to 75% of the American voters and have witnesses, it's a job only half done. He said, going on, you open yourselves up forever as a Senate that shirks its responsibilities. What, Susan, do you think, if in fact they don't take witnesses, what do you think will be the response to this? What will people look at the role of the Senate in not taking witnesses here?
That's an interesting calculation that the Senate is making, because as you alluded to, there was a recent poll that showed 75% of Americans indicated they'd like to see witnesses. I think that when we think of a trial, when Americans think of a trial, they think of witnesses. And so I think that's helping boost those numbers. There was an earlier, I think it was a CNN poll that showed a similar number of people. So it's a large majority of people that would like to see witnesses. But it appears that the Republicans are making a calculation that the fact that they are not going to apparently allow for witnesses and are going to explain this away by saying that this does not lead us to the level of removing the president from office is something that is either going to be forgotten by voters or not considered as important as other kinds of things, decisions that they'll be making.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about the latest in the impeachment trial. I want to give a listen to Democratic House Manager Adam Schiff talking about the likelihood that witnesses won't come out, but that news keeps breaking. Here's a listen.
Just as we predicted, and it didn't require any great act of clairvoyance, the facts will come out. They will continue to come out. And the question before you today is whether they will come out in time for you to make a complete and informed judgment as to the guilt or innocence of the president.
And one of the things he's referring to there is the story from the New York Times today, more from that John Bolton book manuscript, where he says the president had directed him to set up meetings with Rudy Giuliani and the Ukrainian president, adding more detail to what John Bolton says he knows about the story. What do you think about that, Susan, the ongoing trickle of more information coming out as the Senate moves to wrap up the trial?
This has been really interesting just watching. Normally when you think of a trial, you think that you have the evidence and then you move forward with the evidence that you have when you start. But in this case, if you just think back to when the House began its hearings through this afternoon, new information seems, as you said, to continue to trickle out, and it's not inconsequential information. Given all the talk about whether or not John Bolton should testify, would he testify, would he be allowed to testify, and the fact that the Republicans throughout even the early parts of the process in the House were arguing that we've not heard from anyone who has spoken directly to the president, and now we have someone who was quite close to the president in terms of what his role was in the White House, and apparently indicating that he, in fact, was given directions, and now we're seeing that it was a couple months before what we thought, and yet we're hearing that now, but I don't know that it's not going to matter because they're voting on witnesses.
I want to listen to how the president's defense team is making the case against witnesses with Patrick Philbin here, deputy counsel to President Trump, talking a few hours ago.
There's a way to decide right up front, in some quick way, whether there's really a triable issue, whether you really need to go to all the trouble of calling in new witnesses and having more evidence and something like that. And there's not here. There's no need for that. Because these articles of impeachment on their face are defective.
So defective articles of impeachment, therefore no need for witnesses. Is that something you think swayed some Republican senators who might have been on the fence?
I think that some of the Republican senators that were on the fence are looking for a justification for a decision that, quite honestly, I think some of them had come to earlier in the week. And that's just my, honest observation of things. And I don't know that much was going to be done to sway them either way. It's more about what can they be given to use as an explanation for why they're not supporting witnesses.
a lot of people looking at political calculations here and how a vote for or against witnesses, for or against impeachment is going to affect a particular senator. It seems, Susan, like that's going to be really hard to predict at this point. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we all like to try to read the tea leaves and, you know, see, well, how is Susan Collins voting for or against witnesses today going to matter in November? And, you know, we do the same thing with Brett Kavanaugh. We do the same thing all the time. And I think that when it comes to, you know, when it comes to the end of the day in November, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to come into play regarding whether she or others are reelected.
It seems very likely that the Senate will vote to acquit the president here and not remove him from office. That seems like a safe bet. One of the questions now is when. Susan, does it matter if that happens today or this weekend or Wednesday after the State of the Union? Is the timing that important as you see it at this point?
For the president, I think the timing is important. I think that he was hoping that there would have been a quick vote to acquit this evening. And I don't know if there will or won't be. The last I had heard was that there was negotiations going on as to how they were going to move forward after a vote on witnesses. And everything had been pointing to looking like it was going to be a quick vote. And then what I've seen this afternoon is that now Mitch McConnell is saying that perhaps there's a negotiation in place that they would allow for some closing arguments early next week, and then the ultimate vote next week, Wednesday, maybe. I think that short term, the president would have liked this to have been done today. He's giving a big interview to Fox, ahead of the Super Bowl. And he has a State of the Union address on Tuesday. So I think from his perspective, short term, he would have liked this to be done. In the grander scheme of things, it doesn't really matter.
We have, just while we're talking, it looks like the Senate did, in fact, vote against taking witnesses 51-49, which is, I think, the math we expected based mm-hmm. on Senators Alexander and Murkowski saying no witnesses. Now, we're not going to hear from John Bolton talking in front of the U.S. Senate in the impeachment trial. There's been some talk that just because the impeachment is done, it doesn't mean that House committees won't go back and look at some of these issues. Is it a possibility still that someone like John Bolton could get a subpoena from a House committee?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think that the House all along has continued to do certain investigations into the administration. And I think that it is very likely that given the fact that there was a vote to not allow for witnesses, that there will be a renewed call for some of these committees to, in fact, subpoena John Bolton and see if he shows up to testify.
Now, John Bolton had said he would be willing to come and testify if he was subpoenaed by the Senate. There's still the possibility that the Trump administration would try to block his testimony, citing executive privilege. What would you look for in a standoff like that?
Well, at that point, it could certainly, and it would likely go to the courts and then ask the court to make a determination as to what would be and would not be allowed as far as John Bolton's testimony. I think that most people who look at executive privilege claims would argue that this idea of total and blanket executive privilege isn't necessarily what is intended by executive privilege, and that there would be a case to be made that John Bolton should be able to present some information. Plus, we've got the manuscript that's already out there. So, I mean, a lot of this information is already in the public domain.
Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about the latest in the Senate impeachment trial. The latest news, the Senate has voted to not bring more witnesses in by a vote of 51-49. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to that decision to not bring in new witnesses? Disappointed, or do you agree with the president's counsels that there was no need for them at this point? Do you want to see people like John Bolton brought before House committees still to see what they have to say about what they know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the latest in the Senate impeachment trial. Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Latest news, the Senate has voted not to bring witnesses in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the argument that Trump's conduct was inappropriate but didn't meet the high standard for impeachment? Do you think it's important that impeachment be bipartisan? What do you want to see happen next? Do you want to see more investigations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on our callers now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I guess my biggest disappointment with the impeachment process is that it was done so quickly that we still don't have answers to several very troubling questions. The first is, one, does your guest think that Trump will be able to continue to claim executive privilege, or will we litigate the extent of executive privilege for senior aides testifying in front of Congress? Two, do you think there'll be more investigations into the Biden family and if there was any corruption involved there? And three, will they investigate whether Trump was really doing investigation of Ukrainian corruption, or was this purely a political type of situation?
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call and a lot of big questions there. First, executive privilege, Susan, does this set any kind of precedent for the future if we end the impeachment at this point with, Charlie says, this unanswered question?
Yeah, no, I don't think we're going to set a precedent as far as executive privilege goes, because that hasn't been tested in this case or in some of the other hearings. And I think that the House decided to not try to subpoena witnesses that the president said he would claim executive privilege on, and they were criticized by some for not doing that. We may now see that battle play out in that, as we were talking about before the break, the House might now try to subpoena John Bolton and get him to testify, and then there might be that challenge to executive privilege. I think that until the challenges are litigated, we're going to continue to see him use those executive privilege.
And then Charlie's third question, we kind of talked about the House could well continue to investigate the questions about President Trump. As far as investigations of the Bidens, we've seen some senators, including Lindsey Graham, talk about maybe wanting to do investigations, but not separate from the impeachment process. Is that something you might expect to see from Republican senators?
You know, I don't know that we will. I think that there would have to be the will of several people in the Senate who would want to take that up. And I don't know that there's that much interest in the Senate, if they get past impeachment, to then begin hearings on the Bidens.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We'll go to Sheila now in Madison. Sheila, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having my call.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Sheila?
Well, I'm extremely disappointed that they voted not to have witnesses. I really feel like what Mitch McConnell has done is, you know, not any different than jury tampering. It seems very, very evident. And I've watched almost all of this go down, and I haven't been able to do those things in the past, but I feel an obligation now that I have time to do it. And I try to keep an open mind about all of this, but when you listen to the arguments that are presented by the House managers, by the president's attorneys, and the evidence back and forth, but more importantly, the quality of the arguments that are made, you know, made on substance of, you know, considering the evidence versus the president's attorneys and their comments made on whether or not it's a legitimate even legitimate to accuse the president of this, or whether the articles of impeachment are even, you know, valid in this case.
Sheila, thanks for the call. To Sheila's first point, Susan, she's disappointed that there won't be witnesses. I've seen some people sympathetic to President Trump saying, you know, without witnesses, if people don't view this as a complete trial, the idea that the president has been exonerated might be harder to sell.
I don't think he's going to have a problem selling his own exoneration, to be honest. And so I'm not so worried that from the perspective of the president and his supporters that they ever wanted witnesses. And so I think they're quite happy that the vote went as it went, and he'll claim a full victory.
Thanks a lot for that call. We've got a Mike now in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had great hopes for Obama. His first 3 or 4 months, he had control of the House and the Senate and the presidency, and he could have really pushed through a lot of new legislation. I had some hope for Trump that he'd be a little better president and a different president, yes, but, you know, it's clear that he has Mitch McConnell, the Senate, behind him. He's got the Republican Party. And basically, as long as Mitch McConnell is the gatekeeper, we don't have three branches of government. We've got two, and they've pretty much nullified the House of Representatives at this point. And so what I'm hopeful for now is that come November, that the people vote out the Republican Senate coming out like a tidal wave like we did in 2018 and clean out. And hopefully the Democrats do get control of the House and the Senate and perhaps the presidency, that they actually clean up what is a weakness in our Constitution.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike pointing toward the powerful role, Susan, of the Senate Republican majority and Mitch McConnell, both in slowing down President Obama and now in protecting President Trump. Can you talk about the importance of the role that Mitch McConnell as head of the Senate Republican majority has played?
Yeah, I think that when we look back historically at the leadership that Mitch McConnell has shown in the Senate, I think that he's going to go down as being one of the most powerful figures of the early 21st century. And we can think back to the Merrick Garland nomination in the last year of President Obama's term. We can think about what he's been able to do in terms of shepherding judicial nominees in place for President Trump under the Trump administration. And then we can think about what's going on currently with sort of the iron hand that he's held in terms of keeping his caucus mostly together and being able to say from the beginning, we will run this in a very efficient way, and President Trump will not be removed. And he's been running it so far right along the timeline that he promised.
Thanks for the call. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hello.
Yeah, thank you. Two quick questions. How do you think this is going to affect the Senate races throughout the country in 2020? And has there ever been an actual witness testifying that to the innocence of Donald Trump? I mean, basically, we've had witnesses all say that he's guilty in different ways. We've had people refuse to testify or blocked from testifying. But I can't recall a single time from the Mueller report all the way on of anyone actually testifying to the innocence of Donald Trump.
Tom, thanks for the call. Briefly to that point of exculpatory testimony on behalf of the president?
Well, and I think that that's a very interesting question, because what we've seen is quite the opposite. In fact, is what we've seen has been a acknowledgement that what, in fact, he was accused of in terms of exerting pressure on the Ukrainian president in the case of the impeachment specifically, that, in fact, he did. And so it's now about motives, and then it's even kind of moved beyond motives to, if we think about what Alan Dershowitz said yesterday, was even if the motives are not necessarily pure, it's still okay. So, no, to the caller's point, I've not heard anyone testify that it hasn't happened. It didn't happen.
And briefly, to his other point, we can't predict what this is going to mean for the Senate race, but what will you watch for in terms of impeachment and the Senate race between now and Election Day?
I think that in some of the races that are considered more of a toss-up, that the Democratic opponents are going to push really hard and remind voters that their Republican senators did, in fact, support the president and refuse to go along with witnesses and, were unwilling to what they would say, offer a fair trial.
Susan, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She was with us today to talk about the debate in the U.S. Senate over whether to have witnesses in the Senate impeachment trial. There is a vote in on that now. They will not take witnesses. The vote came down 51-49. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll get more on the final days of the impeachment trial of President Trump and what it could mean for the future of the presidency and the 2020 elections. We'll also talk to Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about a lawsuit the state is joining after the Trump administration's rollback of chemical safety regulations. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.